It's here and now. The global death toll from the coronavirus has topped the 200,000 mark. And here in the United States, more than 50,000 people have died from the virus. The toll on economies has also been devastating. And in an attempt to offset the losses, many countries are slowly reopening.
But Tanya, those countries were ahead of us on the curve of the pandemic. So how is reopening going in the U.S.? Georgia, South Carolina, Oklahoma, and Alaska are among the states loosening restrictions. Let's check in with NPR's national correspondent, Kirk Siegler. Kirk, tell us more about states taking the biggest steps to reopen.
Well, as you just said, Robin, you know, you can point to Georgia, South Carolina, even Alaska going the furthest. Some of businesses in those states have already been told that they could reopen, and some of the statewide orders were being lifted already in previous days. And there are some states like Nebraska and Utah that have not even implemented statewide orders, but it's left it up to their local jurisdictions. It's kind of a difficult question to answer, though, uniformly, because really it varies within the region. It doesn't just all fall neatly into, say, partisan lines with Democratic governors going one way and Republicans going the other. And sometimes it can really even vary within the state. You mentioned Georgia. I think that's going to be one to watch for sure. The Republican governor there facing a lot of pressure from his base, if you will, in more rural areas. To reopen, the city of Atlanta saying, wait a second, we're certainly not ready to reopen, at least on a broad level.
Yeah. Well, President Trump said the same thing. He at first backed that Republican governor of Georgia and then said, I think he's moving too fast. So there is a concern that it backfires, that people either don't come out to the bowling alleys or the tattoo shops, or they do and they get sick, and states will have to shut down all over again. So what are you hearing?
Even when you talk to any public health official and a lot of doctors I've spoken to, they're, you know, very concerned about opening up too early. If we do reopen, there's a lot of predictions that we'll see a second wave, and then a business will just have to shut back down again. And that, according to a lot of people I've spoken to, can will probably bring even worse economic effects, not to mention the health fallouts from this, from a second wave. I think the other big open question here is, will, you know, consumers go to these businesses that do decide to reopen? I think there's a lot of wariness in the public right now still. And in fact, a lot of public opinion polls that I've seen recently anyway sort of back that up. It's not clear if a business opens what it's really going to look like and if there will be customers.
And remind us, what are the governors in states that are staying locked down? What are they waiting for or asking for, the steps they want to see before they consider any reopening?
Well, I think you could break that down to two main things. That's testing and contact tracing. You know, you hear repeatedly from the governors of states like California and actually even in Idaho, where I'm talking to you from, that we don't have enough testing. We don't have the ability yet to be able to be staffed up enough to A, test, but also B, have enough contact tracers on the ground. They need to hire thousands of them to be able to isolate cases and do the investigations that are required to prevent a second major outbreak or a second major wave. So it seems like those are the two main things we're hearing. And, you know, that's been kind of all over the map nationally. We haven't gotten any real clear indication from the national government that this is actually in place yet.
Yeah. And Kirk, we just have to ask you, you're there in beautiful Boise, Idaho, mostly rural state. Many people feel they're already socially distancing naturally and that the virus isn't affecting them. And we know that there are groups defying stay-at-home orders. Ayman Bundy, the anti-government militia leader, is leading protests there. Do you think this will pressure the governor there or in that region?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of pressure from the far right on Idaho's governor in particular, who by no means is a liberal, to reopen. There's been claims that this is tyranny, this is overreach from the government. So there is frustration, but I'd say as a large level, people are following social distancing. I went to a protest the other day here in Idaho where there were a couple hundred people, some of them business owners, angry about the blanket restrictions, but it's safe to say hundreds of thousands of people were not there and were at home following the order.
NPR national correspondent Kirk Siegler with that snapshot there from Boise, Idaho. Kirk, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Well, as parts of the country relax social distancing efforts, many health experts are also calling for better testing to keep the virus from roaring back. Researchers in the UK recently looked at the role of testing in controlling the spread of COVID-19, and they found that the effectiveness of widespread testing is not just about the volume of tests, but who actually gets tested. We're joined on Skype by Nicholas Grasley. He's a professor of infectious disease and vaccine epidemiology at Imperial College London. And professor, first off, is the US doing enough testing right now?
Yeah, so I think the US got off to a slow start, as you're aware, but did very rapidly accelerate. And now I think the US is doing more tests than any other country in the world daily. So over 150,000 tests each day. If we think of that as a number of tests per person, it puts it sort of doing slightly better than here in the UK and kind of on a par with many other countries globally. So the US did very effectively catch up during March and into April. And in fact, what we're finding now is that both countries have more testing capacity in their laboratories than is actually being utilized. So here in the UK, we have about double the testing capacity that we're actually making use of. So what we really need is a national testing strategy on who we're giving these tests to and how to get the tests to those people.
Your report says testing is most important for patients and healthcare workers and other high-risk groups. Are those groups getting tests at adequate rates here in the U.S. based on your research?
Yes, so both in the US and the UK, healthcare workers who are showing symptoms of COVID-19 are number one priority for testing. What we investigated in this paper was also whether regular screening of healthcare workers and other at-risk groups, irrespective of their symptoms, could additionally catch infections that are either asymptomatic and also healthcare workers who might be pre-symptomatic, so they're infected but they're not yet sick from the virus. So with weekly screening of healthcare workers, we could catch infections that are either pre-symptomatic or not causing symptoms and isolate those healthcare workers and other at-risk groups so that they don't infect one another and infect patients. We know that healthcare workers are disproportionately represented in the burden of COVID cases. So in Europe, between 4 and 19% of all COVID cases, depending on the country, have been among healthcare workers. If we can detect their infections early, we can identify those who may become sick and prevent further transmission. I would recommend that we pilot doing this and we see how much infection we find before scaling it up to a national level.
Oh, I see. But how effective would more widespread testing have been here in the United States, say, 3 months ago in January?
Yeah, well, it's a difficult question. Certainly, testing is important when there are few imported cases that need to be detected, their contacts traced and isolated. But the number of infected individuals coming into the U.S. in the early part of this year, it would have been hard to stop most of those infections coming into the U.S. Estimates have been put out that suggest only about a third of those infections would have been caught by a system of screening. So I think whilst testing is useful in establishing the early spread, I don't think it would have been effective in stopping the epidemic that we're now seeing in the U.S.
You know, we've been talking a lot about antibody testing. Is that more effective in the general population at controlling the spread, especially as parts of the U.S. start to reopen businesses and really encourage people to relax social distancing?
Yeah, so antibody testing has been proposed as a way of allowing a return to work of people who have those antibodies. So they've been infected, they've recovered, and they show signs of immunity. So these have been called immunity passports. The idea being that they could safely go back to work. And this could apply to healthcare workers, but it could also apply in the general population. There are, however, some significant technical, ethical, and legal challenges to implementing such a scheme. First of all, the tests simply aren't that good at the moment. We need tests that are sensitive and specific. And unfortunately, the tests we have at the moment do risk the chance of falsely indicating a positive antibody status when that person doesn't have antibodies. So there's a risk that you issue an immunity passport to someone who's not acquired antibodies and that may not be immune. One of the second challenges relates to the fact that we don't know whether actually the development of antibodies in blood is in fact protective against COVID-19 if you're subsequently exposed. We know that as your antibodies rise, the virus is cleared from blood. But when you're next exposed to the virus, it's not clear yet whether you're protected and also for how long this immunity might last.
That's Dr. Nicholas Grassley, Professor of Infectious Disease and Vaccine Epidemiology at Imperial College London. Nicholas, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you very much, Tonya.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
So what happens to colleges now? Yes, lives have been lost and devastated by COVID-19, most important. But young lives have also been put on hold. Hopes for first jobs gone, apprenticeships to start climbing the ladder at trade jobs maybe, largely gone. And today, look at what's happening at thousands of colleges and the 14.5 million students who hope to attend them. Can they and their families even afford it? Are schools able to switch entire curriculum online? What happens to a hands-on lab study, for instance, for future nurses? Lee Gardner writes about all of this in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Lee, most schools are shut down. You wrote about one that did it so quickly they left warm cups of coffee on professors' desks. Many went online. So what are they thinking now?
They're thinking a lot of things because no one knows what's going to happen right now. In fact, a lot of them are still reeling from the decisions that they had to make quickly in the spring. It's possible that, if the virus is under control, then they could have a normal move-in day in August. And I think, frankly, a lot of people are sort of hoping that that's going to happen, whether they believe that or not. But a lot of institutions are looking at starting the semester later, maybe starting online and then opening up classrooms and dorms later in the semester, or just doing the whole fall semester online. People are just sort of trying to make plans for all of them because they don't know what the right answer is yet.
Well, talk about that split semester. Many seem to be thinking about that, the idea of maybe 8 weeks, 8 weeks, two courses per 8 week. And that way, if in fact it's safe to open up, they can pivot to having students come. These schools have to decide quickly, deposit to do for the fall. You mentioned shortfall. In the spring, students asked for their room and board back when schools closed. What kind of hit was that for the schools?
So far, it's been pretty substantial. The University of Wisconsin, I think it was $170 million just this spring. Johns Hopkins University, they've lost $350 million just this spring. And now they're looking forward to a fall where the financial uncertainty is magnified to an unbelievable degree.
Well, and you're hearing from students and families that may not find it worth it to pay for tuition for an online class, and they want them to be better than the ones that were kind of slapped together for the spring. Can schools, with everything it takes to do, an online curriculum, it's, building the entire class online, can they do that by the fall? What's happening behind the scenes with schools? And what will students do if they kind of decide, well, maybe I don't want this, some of the things you're hearing?
Well, no one's exactly happy with how the spring went. That is, the people who work at colleges are very proud, and I think they probably should be, that they were able to pivot that fast. But this was an emergency situation. they got classes online in a very quick and dirty fashion. I think students, at least initially, understood that this was an emergency situation and that they were going to finish out their courses. But now that they've been at it for a few weeks and stuck on their couches at home, they're starting to look ahead and maybe starting to question whether or not if they're going to be asked to do that in the fall, especially if they're going to be asked to pay full tuition, whether they want to do that. For their part, the colleges, everyone I spoke to talked about spending the summer to really work on making the online experience better.
You also cite a study that says 1 in 6 college-bound high school seniors are rethinking whether they will even go to school this fall. What are they thinking?
It could mean that they sit home on their couch, as one source put it, pushing back against this idea. I mean, what are they going to do? They're not going to go get a job. You know, they're not going to get an internship. If everything is still locked down, they're literally going to have nothing to do. But it has been put forward by several people, including students and other folks in higher education, that a lot of people might stay closer to home. They might take some classes at their local community college, which is often going to be a lot cheaper than the institution that they might be enrolled at, and just transfer those credits over, assuming that they do go back to another institution. I know, and you may be experiencing this too, the people you know, people in your family who have high school age kids who are looking at college, they're really wrestling with this right now.
How much of a hit will schools take if people decide not to go back? What's your sense of the future of colleges overall because of this?
It's not an appealing future. Many colleges were already having financial difficulties because demographic changes in the United States have meant that there are fewer high school graduates in lots of parts of the country in recent years, and that's made competition for students tougher for a lot of colleges. And so in recent years, a lot of colleges have been missing their tuition revenue goals. Something like this comes along, and some people are estimating that even if campuses are open, as much as 20% of a typical class could stay home. They want to stay closer to home. They want to stick with community college. They don't want to take the risk of showing up on campus in August and then having to bug out again in October or November. That's a huge, huge hit. And international students, usually they're heavily recruited by U.S. institutions because typically they pay full tuition. And their tuition is used to subsidize financial aid for other students. International students may be even more likely to stay away. And in that case, it could not only be a huge tuition hit for institutions, it could also hurt their financial aid for the students who do show up. And public institutions, state colleges and universities, in addition to the enrollment piece of this, they have a whole other financial impact that's going to hit them in the terms of state support. Because this is going to wreck state economies across the country, which means that's going to wreck state support for higher education. One of the first places that states look for cuts, because it's one of the biggest pieces of the pie that they can cut from, and higher education especially, more so than K-12. Pretty much in every state, you're going to see tax revenues drop, which means in pretty much every state, you're looking to see payments to higher education drop. So they're going to get hit with a double whammy on their budgets, and that's not going to be pretty either.
On the other hand, is it possible there's going to be a major shift for young people? You know, more young people not feeling that pressure, I've got to go to school this year because I can't. You know, my family's business closed. You know, maybe I'll do a gap year of necessity almost. You know, do you see the whole landscape shifting possibly?
That's a distinct possibility, and it could happen in a number of ways. I think as far as students go, people talk about how hard it is to get into college, and certainly that's true at a lot of institutions, especially, you know, that top tier of institutions. But higher education generally is becoming more and more of a buyer's market. That is, more and more colleges are hungry enough for students that they are willing to provide financial aid for students, go test optional for students. They're willing to do a lot of things to get students to make that commitment. This has the potential to kind of free them up to maybe make gap years a more regular thing, maybe give them some more options. You know, a lot of colleges as part of this are going to be looking at their financial aid practices,
right,
just because it's going to be in their interest too, because a lot of families are going to be financially disrupted by this, and it's going to be in the college's interest to work with those families to make something happen so that the students can attend. So for students, this will ultimately be an advantage for them in terms of their buying power, if you will, for colleges.
boy, there's a huge emotional part of this story because of that. I mean, young people who were raised to think this is what you have to do in life may not be doing it.
It is. And we're hearing a lot of stories about people who were excited about graduation, especially first generation college students, the first people in their family to graduate, the culmination of maybe generations of dreams, not getting to walk across that stage. There's a lot of emotional things on the line, as well as financial and career concerns.
And you mentioned something that we should mention, which is that whether it's college or community college, when these schools go online, and perhaps for two semesters, there are a lot of low-income students who are going back to homes that don't have broadband, don't have a lot of technology.
That's true. This being another example that has really pointed up some of the equity issues in higher ed. People have this image in their head of a college student, and that sort of equates to a kid who's middle class and has certain advantages and certain resources. And the fact is that many, if not most, college students don't have those things, don't have the access to those things. And one of these days, I think we're going to look back on this and ask whether higher ed did enough to address the issues of equity in this moment. I know a lot of people at campuses are trying really hard to do that right now, but I think at some point we're going to look back and wonder if it was enough.
Lee Gardner, again, of the Chronicle of Higher Education. We've just painted a pretty bleak picture. Do you have anything, you know, that you can glean from this to share with students that might be a little more, you know, uplifting for them? Anything that you're seeing in this?
Well, you know, one of the nice things about colleges is that they're run generally by very smart, very well-meaning people. They have students' best interests at heart and really want what's best for students and want students to come and learn and have a good experience. And so I think that there are probably a lot of people on campuses all across the country right now who are working really hard to make sure that the students get back on campus and get back safely and get back in a way that, you know, doesn't bankrupt their families. When we get back to something like normal, I think that the college experience will still be there for those students.
Lee Gardner, who took a look at how college leaders are planning for the fall, will link you to his article at herenow.org. Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Boy, what a pivot for so many people. Are you a student thinking of not going back to school if it's only online? Can you afford tuition? But what if you stay home and then you still can't go out and work? So many questions. Let us know yours at herenow.org.
And China is reportedly upping its disinformation strategy in the wake of the pandemic. And even though the quantity of that disinformation is new, the style is very familiar. NPR's Miles Parks reports.
Before April of last year, China had basically no presence on Twitter. There were just a few accounts scattered among hundreds of ambassadors and officials. The platform is actually blocked inside China. But Beijing's game plan has changed.
Between September and December, we saw more accounts come online in that 3 months than they had in the existence of Twitter before that.
That's Brett Schaefer. He's the Media and Digital Disinformation Fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy think tank. The organization has been tracking Russian internet activity since shortly after the 2016 election. It recently expanded its database to monitor Chinese online activity as well. It tracks Twitter posts by Chinese officials and also monitors official media channels and statements to the United Nations.
If you're looking at any one of the slices of China's international messaging, you're probably missing the complete picture. So the dashboard essentially was set up as a way of seeing the entire picture.
A few trends have emerged from seeing that picture. One is a move toward a more confrontational style of messaging. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Hua Chunying, for instance, started her Twitter account last October. She now has almost 400,000 followers. A quick look at her profile, and you can see her calling out a White House trade advisor, a State Department spokesperson, and a U.S. congressman, just in the past 3 weeks.
Once the government started recognizing the scale of the crisis, they also sort of went into what I would characterize as damage control mode to try to change the narrative about the virus.
That's Laura Rosenberger, who runs the Alliance for Securing Democracy. She says one of the damage control strategies has been pushing a number of different stories about where the outbreak started, despite all signs pointing to Wuhan, China. Rosenberger says that kind of messaging has a long track record.
That's a strategy we've frequently seen Russia use.
In 2014, for instance, after Russian-backed forces shot down a Malaysian Airlines flight in Ukraine.
Russia, in order to deflect blame from itself for shooting down that aircraft, spread multiple different conspiracy theories about why the aircraft may have actually come down. Not necessarily to convince anybody of one particular idea, but to say it's really impossible to know what happened in this case.
Another messaging theme that the database reveals is just how much China wants to promote itself as a global helper now that it seems to have the virus under control within its own borders. Here's a clip from a Chinese state media video published to YouTube about how China deserves praise for its response.
So for the rest of the world, China has been the bellwether, has really given the rest of the world a lot of information about what this virus does in populations.
The million-dollar question, as Schaefer puts it, is whether this is all a temporary messaging strategy or a sea change in how China looks to craft its global impact. He says the fact that some elements started cropping up during the Hong Kong protests last year may indicate a sustained shift.
Around Hong Kong was the first time that we actually saw Western social media companies, Facebook and Twitter, take down accounts that they had attributed to being run by the Chinese government, covert accounts. So the kind of activity that we saw from Russia, we saw that for the first time being connected back to China.
That would seem to suggest a trend, Schaefer says, that this may be a strategy China can lean on whenever its core interests are threatened. Miles Parks, NPR News, Washington.
Early on in this pandemic, we'd been hearing a lot about the need for ventilators. Now doctors are also seeing an increased need for dialysis machines and supplies. That's because an increasing number of patients with the virus are experiencing kidney failure. Dr. Jonathan Winston is a nephrologist and professor of medicine at Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And doctor, what kind of increase have you actually been seeing in patients needing dialysis during this pandemic?
We're seeing an extraordinary number of critically ill patients in the intensive care unit who are developing what we call acute renal failure. That means their kidneys were normal before they got sick and they shut down in the setting of the COVID infection, and usually in the setting of respiratory failure as well.
Why is this happening?
We don't know exactly why it's happening in terms of the exact underlying cause. We do understand that patients who are critically ill develop kidney failure because they're not getting enough circulation or blood to the kidney. Whether there's something else going on, be it direct effects of the virus itself or microscopic blood clotting, which has been described in other organs, is yet to be settled. But they are certainly critically ill patients, and they're developing a sudden and severe form of kidney failure.
Do you have enough dialysis machines and supplies to give dialysis to all of these people?
We have enough dialysis machines, but we have a relative lack of staff. These patients are virtually all housed in an intensive care unit. And in order to do dialysis in an intensive care unit, we need to set a specially trained technician to the intensive care unit to perform the treatment. Otherwise, one person could take care of 2, 3, or 4 patients at one time if the patients were in a standard dialysis unit. But in the ICU, the staffing ratio is much higher.
Okay. But we also understand that you're having to reduce the amount of time that people get dialysis so that you can treat more people. How exactly does that work?
So when we're used to seeing about 20 patients in an intensive care unit, we're now seeing 60-plus patients, all of whom need urgent dialysis. Under usual conditions, we dialyze patients somewhere between 3.5 to 4.5 hours to efficiently remove the waste products during the treatment. So in this setting, with triple the number of patients and a difference in staff ratio, we just have to cut the treatment short so we can still treat the number of patients that need to be treated.
I guess the next question with that is, are there any long-term consequences to receiving fewer hours of dialysis?
Well, certainly there are short-term problems, and they could be as dramatic as patients dying because their blood chemistries just aren't adequately cleared because of a suboptimal dialysis. So our days are really spent triaging every patient every day to really assess how adequately they are getting treatment and how many treatments they really need. And it's a constant process of juggling, of moving a machine from one bed to another, of substituting reasonable medical therapy. If a patient next door is in higher need for emergency dialysis. So it's something that we're used to in general, but the intensity, the severity, the number of patients, the pressure on the staff is completely different.
Does this impact in any other way regular patients who aren't at quite at the level of needing dialysis, but they need to be seen for their kidney problems? Are you concerned that they aren't going to get the treatment they need?
Yes, absolutely. So now patients who are not infected, who we've been able to manage for just so long, may need treatment themselves. We're definitely seeing more people now without COVID who need help, but we're still trying to honor the appropriate stay-at-home recommendations. So we still certainly think that if patients can stay at home, they should. But there are now, we're seeing more and more patients who just can't stay at home. So that's creeping up on us. So a lot of doctors in a lot of different specialties are anticipating that the consequences of completely focusing on COVID, which had to be done and has to be done, is going to lead to downstream effects in non-COVID infected patients.
Yeah. What is it like for you and your staff to be in the middle of this pandemic, knowing that it could go on for some time?
It's hard to reflect while you're doing it. Our staff, especially nursing staff, dialysis nurses and technicians, have just done an exemplary job. And these are the type of situations, I think, where you just do and you don't really think about it. I do think a lot of providers are stressed, they're anxious, they're worried, but they're also proud to do what we train to do and to do it well. But right now, we're just doing and doing what we were trained to do, and how we feel about it might be sorted out at another time.
That's Dr. Jonathan Winston. He's a nephrologist at the Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. Doctor, thank you so much for taking the time and explaining all of this for us.
Thank you for having me.
Like many states, Ohio has seen a record number of unemployment claims as a result of the virus. Today, Governor Mike DeWine is offering more details about how to reopen the state's economy, and workers will be watching closely as well as business owners. In Cleveland, the owner of a hardwood flooring company talks about how her life has changed and what she misses in the age of COVID-19.
My name is Jesse Bennett. I am the owner of Cleveland Hardwood Restoration. We repair, refinish, restore, install hardwood floors. I typically have about 4 full-time employees on the payroll. As it stands right now, I have 3 people left, you know, doing what we need to do to get people into their homes so that they can stay home. What's up, Bruce?
The joists looks like they buckled.
These are not homes in which it's a luxury to have the floors done. They are, like, dangerous right now. Don't forget this landing over here. I don't know if you noticed it.
Hi, Jesse.
Hi, how are you? I have been giving a lot of virtual estimates and a lot of estimates via video chat.
Okay, I have just a couple of questions.
The uncertainty of how to, like, look forward and how to plan, I guess, has just been something that I've been thinking about every day. Will we go into a recession? Will I be able to support the size company that I had previously? All of these things are unknown.
And I could let your people in the morning.
Yeah. When this is over, I will not take for granted the physical gestures of greeting and thanking people. We're working in their home. So not being able to shake someone's hand to thank them for their patronage of my company that supports my family and the families of all my employees, like, I will not take that for granted, because that is a very big deal.
And Jesse Bennett owns Cleveland Hardwood Restorations in Cleveland. Her story was produced by WCPN's Justin Glanville.
It's Here and Now. The Commerce Department reported last week that retail spending fell by the largest amount on record in March. That will probably not surprise anyone who has walked down a city street with shuttered stores, or if you've switched to online shopping. So how might a city landscape change after this is hopefully all over? Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, is here, as he is most Mondays. And Derek, you write you were walking through your neighborhood in D.C. and you could hear a pin drop.
Yeah, that's right. You know, one thing that I've been thinking about as I've been walking around this city and, you know, looking at pictures of other people who have been walking around their own sort of desolate cities is essentially how much of this is going to come back. You know, I am such a huge fan of, I've only lived in cities in my life. I love cities. I love their idiosyncrasies. And I'm worried that one of the things the plague is going to do is flatten a lot of those idiosyncrasies, because it's going to shut down a lot of the mom and pops that provide the sort of unique character to our favorite neighborhoods and allow chains to proliferate.
Yeah, but even though you concluded that that may happen, you see a silver lining.
Yeah, I do see a silver lining. You know, I think one thing that's going to happen is that in the short term, you're going to see a lot of things accelerate that weren't necessarily positive trends. You're going to see the end of department stores accelerate. You're going to see the rise of e-commerce accelerate. You're going to see the chainification of a lot of American cities accelerate as well. And what this is going to do, I think, for a lot of people is it's going to violate one of the central purposes of cities, which is, you know, the joys of density, the joys of serendipity, the fact that, you know, one's favorite neighborhood in Brooklyn isn't the same as their favorite neighborhood in San Francisco or Boston. And so in the short term, I think this is going to be really, really bad for cities, and a lot of people are going to move. But the reason I think that there's a silver lining here is that if fewer people move to cities, then cities will get cheaper. And if they do get cheaper, then that means that a new generation of countercultural people and artists and innovators and restaurateurs will move into the city in a few years, and we'll see sort of a new golden age.
Well, you know, frightening at first for someone who might be thinking, wait, I don't want to wait 10 years for my neighborhood to come back. But it started me thinking about, you know, New York City after the terrible crack epidemic. And you know, some of the worst of the times that city saw in the 70s, 80s, and, you know, national economic problems adding to that. But it became affordable. It became a place where, as you said, new people could move in and live and create more foot-trafficked New York City, the New York City that we know now. So right. Is that what you're saying?
That is essentially what I'm saying. You know, I liken it to a forest fire. I think that the pandemic will be an urban forest fire because, look, there's going to be a lot of tragedy, I think, in the next few months, the next year. There's going to be a lot of, you know, favorite restaurants and favorite stores that are going to close and never open again. And that will be real ruin. But what happens after a forest fire is that new things grow that couldn't grow before. You know, one thing that's happened across American cities is that they've gotten really, really expensive. Well, if everything that I'm saying is right, if you do have a lot of ruin in cities, then those sort of places are going to be open and affordable in the next few years. And that's why I think we still might see this rebirth.
Well, but yeah, I mean, it's what a grim prospect before that. This forest fire, this urban forest fire. I mean, you talk about fewer mom and pop stores, less immigration, meaning less of that flavor that it brings to cities and that cities like New York celebrate. In the short term, boy, that's tough.
It will be tough. And flavor is an interesting word. You know, I spent a lot of time in this piece thinking about what's going to happen to restaurants. And I think that a lot of people listening will agree that we've kind of been in a golden age of restaurants in America. What happens is more of that spending goes to delivery. And 70% of delivery right now is pizza and Chinese food. And so I think that this might change the taste of American food in the next few years. I liken it actually to Prohibition. Exactly 100 years ago, the prohibition of alcohol changed a lot of fine dining restaurants. A lot of them had to shut down because the most profitable business had been taken away from them. And as a result, the taste of American food was nudged toward kids' meals, you know, hamburgers and shakes, that the mid-century diner experience in the United States. And comfort food also thrives through delivery. So I see a bit of an historical rhyme here. I think that the same thing that Prohibition did to fine dining, I think you're also going to see that in the delivery future of American restaurants.
Just real quick, if what you see in the near future is people fleeing a city as small mom-and-pop stores flee the city and it doesn't have the attraction and the character that it had before, where do they go?
That's a great question. You know, some of them might go to, you know, smaller downtown areas in the West and the Northwest, but a lot of them will move to suburbs. And in order for them to be able to move to suburbs, it's important to say that, you know, a lot of new housing will probably have to be built. And so I do think that in 2 or 3 years, we might have a kind of interesting housing boom in the suburbs if we can plan for it. I think there will be demand to literally socially distance across the U.S. But I think an important point to make is that you can't move into a house that doesn't exist. And so we'll see if that housing does come online the next few years.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. With some grim short-term news, but maybe a silver lining on the other side of it. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, I worry that after COVID-19, right behind it, climate crisis. Okay, Debbie Downer here. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.